Welcome to the American Cinematographer Podcast. Go behind the scenes with today's top filmmakers as they discuss the techniques they bring to the art of motion imaging.
This podcast is brought to you by VideoBlox. VideoBlox is a members-only website offering a one-stop shop for affordable stock footage, motion backgrounds, and After Effects templates. Podcast listeners can get access to an unlimited library and global marketplace for only $99 by visiting videoblox.com/ASC. Welcome to the American Cinematographer Podcast. My name is Ian Marks, and I'm a contributing writer for American Cinematographer magazine. This episode is about the TV show Gotham, which offers a new take on the Batman origin story, in which a young Bruce Wayne, aided by then-detective Jim Gordon, sets out to find the truth behind his parents' murder. Meanwhile, Gotham City itself is overrun by crime and a new breed of weird and dangerous criminal. Not based on any one Batman book or story, Gotham possesses a unique graphic style that foregoes realism in favor of a more expressive, comic book-influenced approach. The pilot was shot by David Stockton, ASC, and the regular series cinematographers are Christopher Knorr and Crescenzo Notaril, ASC. All three received ASC award nominations for their work on the show, and Notaril was nominated for an Emmy in 2016. Recently, Notaril sat down with American Cinematographer to discuss his creative vision for Gotham's third season, currently filming in New York City. So before we start talking about Gotham, I saw on your IMDb page that you worked on Michael Jackson's Moonwalker, which was probably one of my favorite movies growing up, and it still is one of my favorite films today. And I know that there are a lot of cinematographers credited on that movie, but what was your involvement?
I was doing a lot of music video work at the time with a director-producer by the name Jerry Kramer. And when this project came up, at that time I was side-by-side with him. I think there were three cinematographers. I was one of three. I did a lot of the musical portions of it. The Beatles song Come Together, a lot of the animation going through the deserts, all that backstage concert stuff with Michael. But that was a fun shoot because I was a very huge fan of Michael Jackson. I considered him to be a genius, and to watch him work at that time, I was very impressed because he was such a perfectionist. He was a very introverted, shy person. But what really stood out in my mind at that time is when he was on stage and doing his job as an entertainer, as a performer, he came to life in a fantastic way. And what I learned from that is when you know what you are planning to do for the rest of your life, you come alive when you're given that opportunity. So when I walk onto my stage, which is the film set, that is my turn, that is my church. I learned a lot from that particular project, and it was quite fun at the time. Obviously, at that time, there was an extraordinary amount of music videos going on. We all learned a lot, and to this day, I still practice that tenacity, that exploration, especially now with Gotham. Whether it's the use of colors, camera movement, you know, I learned a lot of that through my music video days.
So how do you get from Moonwalker to Gotham? It doesn't seem like such a huge creative leap.
There's been a tremendous amount of projects and years and growth. I came up the ranks. I started off as a camera production assistant. I worked my way up the ranks as a camera loader, second camera assistant, first camera assistant, camera operator, and now as a director of photography. I got into the business, I guess you could call it nepotism. My father was an art director, and I could be audacious by saying he was a genius art director in the field of advertising. His photographer was Richard Avedon, the famed Richard Avedon. And when I was a small boy from 4 years old to about seven, I used to go with my father to his agency and to watch him work. And I used to see Richard Avedon shoot a lot of product material for my father and ad campaigns, not knowing who he was at the time, of course, but I was in front of that world when I was a very small boy. So I knew when I was 5 years old that I wanted to become a photographer. So that was always in my blood. And I guess my chromosomes, my genes, the artistry of that aspect also came from my parents, my father. My father, like I said, was an art director. My mother was a sculptress. So I have that artistic genes inside of me. To answer your question, I started off as a cameraman shooting music videos. That was a great way, a great introduction for young green cameramen to learn, to explore, to be challenged without having an ad agency over your back. And at that time when MTV first started, that genre of music video was tremendously large and really very exciting. And I happened to be there at the right time. My mentor at the time was a director photographer by the name of Tony Mitchell. He was doing an extraordinary amount of music videos as well, and that's how I learned. And then when I was given the opportunity to shoot small music videos, I took it. And before I knew it, then I got into the commercial genre. As I still continued doing my music videos, I now made the leap into the commercial genre. And I was doing a lot of commercials and music videos at that time for about 10 years. And within the 10 years, obviously, Moonwalker came up because I was shooting a lot of music videos for the director, producer, Jerry Kramer, who did that project at that time. And when September 11th happened, I was traveling all around the world, shooting music videos, shooting commercials. I told my agent I didn't want to travel so much. And she had asked me, you have any interest in doing a television pilot? And I said, where is it? She said, Los Angeles. That's where I was living. I said, okay, sure, I'll take it. It happened to be a pilot for Mr. Jerry Bruckheimer, a pilot called Skin. I did that pilot. And from that moment on, I kind of got sucked into the television genre. I wanted to break out a bit at times, but when you have loyalty to executives and producers and network and studio personnel, it's hard to just do one season and step away because the train is rolling, the machine is running, they rely on you tremendously. You have a tremendous amount of responsibility executing the show. So it's very hard to step off that train when you're on a particular project. So cut two, I'm still here in the television genre. And this particular show that I'm shooting now, Gotham, why and how I'm on this particular show is the show I was on prior to this was a show called CSI. And I did the last 5 years of the 15-year stint of the mothership CSI Vegas. And the executive producer of that show, who did the pilot as well, Mr. Danny Cannon, we befriended each other from that show. And he started this show, Gotham. And when CSI finally finished after 15 years, he brought me onto this show, Gotham. So he's now my new boss on this particular show, and here I am.
You came on season two, correct?
On Gotham, yes, season two. And I'm currently now shooting the mid-season finale of season three.
Was it a challenge to join a show that already had an established style?
It always is, yes, because everyone has a different personality of viewpoint, of visual aesthetics, a lot of which was already established. So when you come onto a show like that, it gets a little daunting because you want to make sure that the marriage is proper for your own personal sensibility. Obviously, you want to stretch, you want to grow, you want to explore. It's fantastic to do different things and to be challenged in a very inspirational way that you're not accustomed to. So yes, it was very daunting for several reasons. One, I wasn't necessarily a comic book fan at the time, meaning I was not one of those people who go to a newsstand and get comic books to read. I was not one of those. So here I was delving into a genre that was a DC comic book, and I knew nothing of the comic book world per se. So that in itself was very daunting to me. To get back to your initial question, when something is already established, my job, after listening to everyone and obviously watching the shows and studying the shows and doing my homework, I have to dig deep in my heart to see if I can keep that train running in a very smooth way. Because the last thing I'm sure the studios or the network wants is for someone to step in and all of a sudden things look very different. They had a tremendous amount of success the first season. So obviously I didn't want to regress that success or that viewpoint or that so-called quote unquote look. My job was to step up to the plate and hopefully to enhance matters. I would say to myself, I guess that's the reason why they were hiring me, is my personality, my work, my aesthetics, they thought was good enough to bring to their particular table at the time to continue their train running and hopefully to step up and challenge certain areas and maybe to lift it up a bit in my personal way. My fellow cinematographer, my partner, Christopher Knorr, who's doing a fantastic job as well. He's also being challenged, as we both are, each and every single episode, whether it's between each other with our conversations, the particular scripts, the fact that we're progressing and advancing as a show. We're constantly, perpetually being challenged as far as what we personally could bring to the table. It's wonderful to work with a partner that there's no ego. I can't say that wholeheartedly enough because I've been involved in shows in the past where you have a partner, a rotating DP, where you feel a little creative tension, you feel a little ego there. When I say the word ego, I don't mean that in a negative way. That's more in a tight-collared, close vest way where everyone has their particular tricks of the trade. Everyone has their particular techniques, ways of executing certain photographs, certain things that they have learned in the past, certain tools that they've designed or created. And they try to keep that very close to their vest. It's very hard to find someone to open their hearts and to share what they have learned. My partner, Christopher Knorr, and I, we're brothers. We love each other. We share with each other. I think the testament of the show in terms of our work is proof right there that a lot of people cannot tell the difference between one show or the other. Obviously, a trained eye can see a little personal thumbprint here and there. Obviously, we have two different ways of executing work. So I hear from my crew. We have two different personalities, of course, and two different aesthetics, personal viewpoints. But as a whole, you know, we are there together in the what I call the cinema trenches. And last year, you know, we were both nominated for an ASC award. And that was a testament to our work as well. Out of five nominations, we were two out of the five. And when you look at all the shows that are out there right now, wonderful, brilliant shows, and I have tremendous admiration for most of my colleagues. I think there are a lot of them are geniuses, creative generals out there. So to be nominated within that category of people, along with my partner, I think that said a lot to our particular show, Gotham. So we were both very proud of that.
We talk about the quote unquote look of Gotham, and how would you describe that?
Obviously, Gotham has a very finite, distinct look. I think that's what makes this show stand out amongst many, many other shows. The look of the show is certifiably a principal character. The fact that we are in a genre of a comic book, DC Comics, and we're in that graphic novel world, it gives me, as a cinematographer, that creative license to think outside of that box. There's no real way of looking at things. We're not in a real world. Like, I'm not shooting Law and Order, real, natural, out in the streets, or shows like that. So it gives me, as a cinematographer, that creative license to stretch colors, to stretch camera angles. And because you put all those ingredients into that composition, it makes this particular show, this particular project, stand out. Not only with the use of colors, which a lot of shows explore with, but with composition. Like I said, prior to this show, I was doing a show called CSI, and my close-ups on CSI were like 150 millimeter to 250 millimeter. On this particular show, my close-ups can range from a 21 millimeter to a 32 millimeter. I'm literally a foot away from my principal actors' faces with wide-angle lenses shooting their close-ups, whereas on CSI, I was 40 feet away shooting close-ups. That alone gives the show a unique personality of look. When you're in close to the subject with a wide-angle lens, in my opinion, you're more in their skulls. Their faces become a little more spherical. You're in close with them in a very intimate way, although you're not conscious of that. But subconsciously, it's like you and I are sitting right now having this interview. We're just several feet away. You feel that when you have a wide-angle lens up close, and you feel those eyes round a bit. You feel that face round a bit. You feel the sphericalness of the skull of that person in front of you. As a result of that, I believe it gives it a little more strength. It gives it that third dimension. Obviously, when we watch television, it's a two-dimensional form. But I personally feel when you have those particular lenses and use of compositions, you actually feel the depth, which to me is that third dimension. You actually feel that face popping out of that screen. That's a very unique signature to the show. I think that's probably the first most powerful thing I would say as far as what gives this show that uniqueness. Obviously, we are very monochromatic. The fact that we are in a world of Gotham, no one really knows where that world is. We make it our own world. It's not New York, it's not Chicago, it's not San Francisco, it's not anywhere else. It's not a metropolitan city that we know per se. Gotham we create as our own world. So it gives us that license to play with those colors. And I personally love to juxtapose that monochromaticness of, say, cool cyan with maybe a warm amber bulb, a sconce, or a practical light somewhere in the frame. I personally find that fantastic when you have something very blue overall in frame and you have a warm golden amber dot somewhere in frame to juxtapose that spectrum. I think that's a fantastic visual. A production designer who I think is a genius, his name is Richard Berg. We work very close together, and testament to the crew, I believe we are all artists on this particular show. It's amazing. I've been around the world so many times, worked with so many crews. This particular bunch have tremendous hearts and creative vision, truly, wholeheartedly, unselfishly. They're constantly whispering in my ear about their ideas. What do you think of this? What do you think of that? Oh, I love that. Maybe we should do this. And it's really inspirational to work with crews that are really challenging your directions. And that also enhances the look of the show. Obviously, the look of the show, and I could boldly say this from the very beginning, comes from our showrunners. We have Bruno Heller, who is in charge of our writing team, and my dear friend and my beloved colleague, Mr. Danny Cannon, who's also one of our lead directors. He is my keel, my creative keel of the show. He's a very visual director. I love working with him for that reason, because he pushes me tremendously with my vision, and that pushes me and that inspires me. The look of the show, I would say, mostly came from him at the very beginning. That's how that seed was planted. And here we are as cinematographers, production designers, etc. We're trying to water that seed, let it blossom into our own particular individual hearts as a collective team.
How would you say you've been able to place your thumbprint on this show?
Well, as I said before, each individual has their own personality, their own way of working, their viewpoint, the way they delegate, the spirit on the set, how they intellectualize things, how they interpret things. No two individuals are alike. You and I could read one page of a script, or actually one scene of a script, or even actually one shot. You and I will definitely place the camera in a very different position. It's a thumbprint. So my chromosomes, my genes, my personality is very individual, of course, just like yours are yours. So when I come onto the set, innately, it's going to be different. It's going to be different because of how I interpret and read a script or a scene, because of how I delegate matters to the crew. I will have an impulse that's going to be different from everyone else to place a camera or to know what colors I want to feel for that particular emotion of that story. I'm one of those DPs in that prep is extremely important, especially when you have a large circus behind you. Because without prep, it could be a complete mayhem with equipment, with staging, blocking. I'm very anal with my prep. I'm very, very organized with my notes. I pre-visualize each scene to the most detail I could possibly imagine at that time, because I want to go in on the set with a plan in my mind. And I'm going to say something very profound, because I never thought about this until recently, is that plan that I so-called just finished expressing to you, is I try to plant those seeds in my head before I get onto the set. When I get onto this set, I don't want to be conscious of those plans, those seeds, truly. I just know that they're tucked in my mind in the crevices in the back of my head, that I could pull out that drawer if I need to pull it out. But I'm one of those DPs that do not want to rely on that. What I want to rely on is my creative spontaneity at that time on the set, when I feel it, when the actors come out and I feel the energy from my director and I look at the production design of the set. If I start overthinking things and getting my nose buried in my notes, it's going to break up my rhythm. So when I get onto the set, I'm extremely spontaneous. I was always like that. Just like a prize fighter gets in the ring. You know, you prep and you train as much as you can prior to getting in that ring. But once you slide in those ropes onto that canvas of that ring, or once I open that door to a soundstage onto my set, I'm going to fight now. And I don't know how I'm going to fight yet until I feel that energy around me. Sometimes I could take a slow back pace, voyeuristic point of view and just let everything settle, let those clouds and energy settle. Or I want to be in there so tenaciously with bold angles, bold colors, and just crack that whip really hard. And that's my personality. When I grew up, I was never those kind of directors or photographers that wore light meters around their waists and getting a spot meter on a window or a color temperature meter on a light to match color temperatures. I was never like that. I learned something very profound on the very, very first film that I was camera operator on, which was a film called Once Upon a Time in America, directed by Sergio Leone. That was the first film I was camera operator on. And what I learned from that film, amongst many things that I've learned, I was very enamored by Tonino Delicoli, the director of photography of that film. I used to watch him go around the set and light the set and choose his camera positions and choices of color gels, etc. But I never once saw him pull out a light meter, whether it was a spot meter to check his ratios or a color temperature meter to check his color temperatures of the lights that he was mixing with. I found that very fascinating. He was one of those DPs that never used the light meter. And at the very, very end, when they called out first team and we were ready to shoot, he would pull out this really very small $25 reflective Siconic light meter from his pocket in his shirt and take a very quick reading and just call it to the camera assistant. And I learned something from that, and that was that you light from the heart. You hear that expression all the time, and it's a casual thing that we throw out. And until you become a little more mature and a little more advanced with experience, you realize how profound that simple statement is. Because when you're learning, you become so enamored with all the elements, all the dynamics in front of you, technically speaking. And young cinematographers, I give a lot of lectures to young cinematographers. And that is one thing I talk about extensively is lighting and creating from the heart. Because when you're learning at the very beginning, at the ground floor, your mind gets clogged sometimes because you're thinking about the right way to do it, technically, etc. And you don't realize that when you put all that aside and you just be yourself, go with your heart, be pure about that, and consciously think that way. When you have this world of dynamics, these technical dynamics around you, you get absorbed into that minutia, and it clogs your way of thinking. It clogs that process. Even this day, 30 years of shooting, Ian, when I'm on a film set, sometimes I have to force myself to close my eyes or just get the silence in my head, take a step back in my mind and say, Crescenzo, put all that aside for a moment, open up your heart. What do you think is the best way of executing this particular shot? Putting all the technical stuff aside. And that clears my vision often. So I've always squinted my eyes. I've always went with my gut. If there was a mix of color temperature, you know, incandescent lighting, and then there's a fluorescent cool white, you know, lighting fixture behind me that's casting a very green tinge. I was never one of those that pulled out a color temperature meter. Oh my God, that's too green. Put some magenta gel on it to match the color temperature of the tungsten lighting. I've always welcomed the mix of color temperature.
I want to jump in on this idea because maybe you can express the difference between the art of photography, which some might say you can learn in a semester, versus the art of seeing, which I imagine could take a lifetime.
That is true. It does take a lifetime. That's a very, very mature question and a very mature conversation we could have just on that. That's like religion right now. It could be really vast in depth. Just on that particular viewpoint, the art of seeing. It's very difficult to articulate that because most of that comes from the heart. It comes from an innate chemistry thing that we feel in our minds, in our hearts. It's hard to articulate that.
It gets back to what you were saying about being able to operate on instinct.
It does. I mean, here I am talking to you. You're sitting in a chair in front of me. We're in a corner in a lobby here. There's a sconce above your head. I can compose you in a very interesting way where I could put your head, in just your head, on the bottom right corner of the frame and fill the rest of the 85% of the real estate of that frame with the architecture behind you versus filling the entire frame with your body in a very normal pedestrian way. You will look at those two photographs side by side and it will evoke two different energies, two different viewpoints. Two different emotions. If I put your head in the bottom corner of the frame and be very asymmetrical with that composition, I'm obviously making a statement, a very against the norm statement to choose that photograph the way it's composed. What am I saying? It becomes evocative. Because it becomes evocative, you now stare at it a bit longer. You're now thinking a bit more on it. Now I'm thinking about a narrative, the art of seeing. What's in front of you that's out of frame? I'm trying to evoke that when an audience looks at that. Where are we? Let them imagine now, where are we? What am I saying when I'm putting your head in the corner of the frame? That's a very conscious viewpoint. So the art of seeing, it forces the audiences, not only their eyes, but also their minds. And that's extraordinarily powerful to me. And that's a responsibility of a cinematographer, is to manipulate that eye, whether it's a conscious eye or a subconscious eye. And I call it the third eye. It's not necessarily two eyes just looking at something, but it's that third eye, that cyclops eye, which filters straight into your heart. I can't tell you, Ian, I get off so much when I'm doing something so simple on a camera, and you see someone crying as a result of it, an audience crying. You and I talking right now, a simple move of a camera moving in slowly to your face as we're talking. All of a sudden, the audience now is now not just outside of your face, now they're inside of your skull, wondering what you're feeling and what you're thinking as you are looking at me as I'm talking to you, because the camera's moving in. It's manipulating your eye, your feeling. And we're not conscious of that as an audience member per se. Camera's pushing in, okay, now I'm in his eyes. Camera's pushing in a little further, now I'm in his skull. Now you're wondering what he's thinking about because he's just sitting there in silence looking at you. At the very end of that move, the camera booms down a little. It gave you a little more power. All of a sudden, that point of view got much more slanted in a very profound way. Maybe you were about to pull out a knife and strike me, or maybe you're about to have a very loud response to something I'm saying because of that little move I just made. Now, the audience members are on edge. They're a little more uncomfortable, maybe. They're now sitting at the edge of the seat expecting something to happen. They're a little more uneased about that push in of that camera. And it was a very simple move. Within a 2-second shot, it was a very simple move, but it was a world of information that you are now feeling inside of your body, whether you're aware of it or not. And then all of a sudden, the camera may just sit there for a while, a very long silence with no words, no music, forcing the audience to look at something. Maybe they're now going to cry because of what something was said 2 minutes ago. And now you're inside of their heads. And then all of a sudden, and I find myself doing that often when I watch a film, all of a sudden I will see a tear or feel a tear roll down my cheek of my face out of nowhere. And I love that feeling. I love that power of cinematography, of photography, where you're manipulating an audience's heart to a point where it manifests itself into a tear of an eye.
How does that spontaneity that you've talked about express itself in your work on Gotham? Because there are so many opportunities to be expressive in this show.
I have a lot of opportunity on this show to express that. I'm giving tremendous license, like I said at the beginning of this conversation, to think outside of the box, to think on levels of that kind of emotion. We have extraordinary, an ensemble cast of characters on this show. Each one is so discernibly, significantly different from the others, from one to another. I try to interpret as much as I can my way from one character to the next. One character, I may want to have the camera lower and a little further away to give him a little more power. Another character, I may want to be in closer and a little higher with a wide-angle lens just to be a little more comical in a dramatic way to round their face and to get in there. With women, with our women characters, obviously I want to be as beautiful as I can. On this show, we have such sharply defined characters with our women that are very dark. So I'm not so precious about putting diffusion filters on the cameras to make them so beautifully lush and creamy skin tones like a fashion models. I'm not afraid to put the camera on the floor looking up at our female characters because after all, it is Gotham.
You got an Emmy nomination for your work on the season 2 episode, Azrael. Can you tell us a little bit about the scene you chose for consideration and why you chose this scene?
I was very proud of that particular episode. That's why I had entered it in this year's Emmys, and I was very proud that I was nominated for that. To me, that particular episode was very, very against the norm and very difficult for a cinematographer because one particular scene made me choose this particular episode for entry was we had a blackout in GCPD. And GCPD, when you walk into that set, I always do the sign of the cross when I walk into that set because I feel like I'm always walking into a cathedral. It is the most magnificent set I've ever been on. And it's a police station. But when you physically walk into this soundstage and it takes up the entire soundstage, multi-levels, tremendous wrought iron arches, tremendous arched windows that are 30 feet high, it is magnificent. A tremendous amount of lighting and grid work and practicals are in this particular set. So when we had this blackout, all of that lighting was taken away from me. Now we have the biggest fight sequence we've ever had, where we have a monster with a sword and a cape and a mask fighting the entire squad of all the police inside of GCPD. And I chose this particular sequence to enter in the Emmys because it was very difficult for a cinematographer to light this sequence. And I thought, who's going to understand more of what it takes to shoot this than my fellow colleagues, my fellow cinematographers? And that's why I chose that particular episode. So I found myself asking many questions to myself as I was lighting. Since all the lighting was taken away, what is now motivating the lighting? Obviously, I had to rely on the windows. Thank God there was windows in there. So I relied on the moonlight coming through the windows. So surgically, I had to create paths and beams of light, of moonlight, all within the choreography of this fight sequence.
And there's this moment right after that on the GCPD rooftop where Azrael escapes while being shot at by the police. And the bullets, they throw these sparks when they ricochet off the metal surfaces and the concrete. And it looks like he switched lenses or added an effect filter to change the shape of the flares.
Well, that was extremely perceptive of you, Ian, to recognize that on that particular scene, because you are correct in use of my streak filters, et cetera. That is correct. There was 360 degrees of real skyline, practical rooftop in Midtown Manhattan. And we're up there on a night shoot, and all the practical windows of all that skyline is beautifully lush around you at the beginning of the day. But there comes a time at night, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, where all that eye candy is now taken away from you because all the buildings, all the offices are now closed. So I said to myself, okay, how do I make this interesting now? There's a fight sequence on top of a rooftop. There's all these guns being shot, and you see all these squibs of sparks going off. We've seen that a million times. Okay, how can I make this look a little more interesting? So you were very perceptive about looking at those streaks of light. And yes, that is correct. I used a streak filter, which I personally thought was very audacious, very against the norm. I was actually very proud of that decision. I was concerned at the very beginning if I was being too over the top, too precious, too indulgent about that. But then I checked myself. I said, Crescenzo, you're shooting Gotham. You're shooting comic. You're shooting graphic novel. Get your nose back in there and be as wild as you possibly can. And that is the beauty of the show. It makes you think that way, which is really fun to a cinematographer. So yes, I slapped on some streak filters. I had flashlights outside of the frame of the mat box at times, xenon flashlights, where I would flash the lights inside of that mat box as the guns were being shot to get streaks of light by way of the streak filters, a cacophony of light for a very simple sequence. And I thought, yes, that's my job, is to make something out of nothing. I didn't think about that in my prep, per se. I relied on my guts. So that showed me personally a testament that when you think loud inside of your heart, you're rewarded.
How is the time that you've spent on Gotham, in Gotham City, affected your instincts as a cinematographer because you are allowed to take these kinds of risks?
Yeah. I give a lot of that credit to Danny Cannon, my showrunner, because I'm a city boy at nature. I've grown up in a city. I grew up in New York most of my life. I love the energy, the culture, the fast pace, the balls of the city. I've been shooting in Los Angeles for the past 10 years straight. I love Los Angeles tremendously, but I was really very happy to change that pace of coming here into Gotham, into the city, especially a show like this. Fortunately, it really gave me an injection of something that I desperately needed. I found myself getting in a so-called trap, working in Los Angeles for the past decade, of thinking in a one-way direction, thinking very safely, thinking inside of that box. And there's many reasons why, I guess, not only the nature of the project I was taking and shooting, but just the lifestyle itself. But being here in the city, my camera is out 100 times more here than in Los Angeles. That alone inspires me a great deal to think about my compositions again, to think about my photography again, to think about myself again as a photographer, as opposed to just a cinematographer working for other people. I'm now digging back in my heart of my aesthetics. Walking around the streets, you cannot help but pull out your camera and you're taking 100 photographs by the time you get to the next corner. I love that. That's what I'm about. I'm a photographer. I'm a cinematographer. I love the stimulation around me. And because of all of that, it makes my work as a cinematographer that much more stronger. And of course, I'm bringing that to my current project here on Gotham. And each day that I work, each episode that I shoot, as I continue, I do feel myself getting stronger. I do feel myself getting a little more bolder in my approach. Not only in my approach as far as compositions and colors and choice of how I shoot a particular scene, but just my approach on how I delegate my aesthetics to my crew. Just my approach on my energy on a film set now. My approach to be a little more extroverted with my colleagues. So it is changing me. Again, 30 years shooting in this business. Here I am doing this particular project, being nominated for an ASC, being nominated for an Emmy. I'm 56 years old right now, been shooting 30 years, and I feel like I'm 17 years old. My work is extraordinarily strong right now. I feel I'm at my best. It's important to be inspired, not only with your own particular person within yourself to be inspired, inspired by the photography books that you buy to inspire you. I love buying photography books. I still do. I have thousands and thousands of photography books that I constantly look at. Before each particular project, I pull out many photography books, a lot of which I'll go to a corner stationery store, a corner FedEx, UPS, whatever Kinko's, and I'll make Xeroxes and I'll put together a tear sheet book, a lookbook for myself. Sometimes I'll give it to my directors to inspire each other of just things that I like, whether it's textiles of fashion, whether it's just the way things were composed, the colors of particular photographs, et cetera, et cetera. Just to feed my subconscious, just to feed the crevices of my mind, whether I'm conscious of it or not, I want to feed my library inside of my mind and my heart as much as I can. So when it's my time to shine, my time to work, it's all going to pour out in very different magical ways, whether I'm conscious of it or not. Sometimes, you know, I will admit, sometimes it doesn't pour out as much as I want it to. Sometimes it just floods out like a floodgate because of my library inside of myself for 30 years of shooting. So to get back to your initial question about my inspiration and how my work is changing right now and being here in the city, in Gotham. Yes, it's changing me not only as a man right now again, but also as a photographer, as a cinematographer. A lot of my colleagues back home in Los Angeles, you know, it was funny, and I say this in a very respectful, friendly way. Oh, Crescenza, why do you want to go to New York? It's so abusive there, the cold, the winter. Why are you going to drive yourself crazy? You know, stay here in Los Angeles. It's, you know, it's serene, it's beautiful. put the top down, go to the ocean. You know, why do you want to do this to yourself? And I will admit, at one point, I thought about that really very carefully. Do I want to work that hard on a particular project after X amount of times in this industry? But I said to myself, because again, that's who I am, fuck it. Yes, I'm going to go to New York. I'm going to dive in the trenches. I'm going to walk the slimes of the streets. I'm going to climb the tenement buildings. I'm going to put myself in the dark, smelly urine alleys. I'm going to do all of that just to get back to my roots. I was nervous at the beginning of that. It's very arduous doing that. I complain and bitch about that every day because it's very difficult. But when you look back on your particular project that you have shot, that's your reward.
Well, the slime of the streets has never looked so good. So,
thank you,
Crescenza. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your work on Gotham. We're looking forward to seeing more of it as the season 3 continues.
I appreciate that, Ian, and I thank you very much.
That was Crescenzo Notario, ASC, talking about his work on the television series Gotham. You can find more podcasts and content on the web at theasc.com.
This has been the American Cinematographer Podcast. Thanks for listening. You can find more podcasts, blogs, and exclusive ASC content by logging onto theasc.com. This podcast has been brought to you by the American Society of Cinematographers, a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the art and craft of cinematography.